The Book Nook on WYSO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We've got the Best of the Book Nook coming up for you this morning. And we're taking another dig into our archive and pulling out the second interview I did with the cultural critic Harold Bloom, recorded back in 2001. And we talked about a book called Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. Harold Bloom is a controversial figure, an amazing guy, but when you hear him recite poetry from memory, you will be amazed. That's coming up on the Best of the Book Nook following the news. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1998, I recorded an interview with Professor Harold Bloom for his book, Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human. And 3 years later, he returned for a second visit to the program to talk about another book he had just put out called Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. When we recorded that interview in 2001, Harold Bloom had just marked his 50th anniversary on the faculty at Yale University. He graduated from Yale in 1955 with a PhD and immediately joined the faculty at age 21. When we recorded this interview in 2001, he had recently turned 71 years old. He is still on the faculty at Yale. He's had an amazingly long career, and he's quite an interesting fellow. At the time we recorded this interview, he was caught up in another kerfuffle. He tends to attract them, or at least he did for some period. And at the time, he had written a rather scathing review of the first Harry Potter book and published it in the Wall Street Journal. And as this interview opens, I make a reference to that controversy, and he comments on it. Here's Professor Harold Bloom, recorded back in 2001. We call it the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Harold Bloom. He has a new collection out called Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. Welcome back, Harold.
Thank you, Vic. I'm glad to be back.
Harold, I saw this book and I said to myself, is this another volley across the bow of the HMS Potter?
Well, I know that a number of people might think so, and it is true that about I can't remember how long ago that was. Maybe you can remember, Vic. It is true that I rather notoriously wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed piece on Harry Potter, in which I confessed to a certain, shall we say, aesthetic unhappiness with the quality of Rowling's prose and storytelling and characterization. And that subsequently, Max Booth, the editor of the op-ed page, got in touch with me and said, Harold, we've never had a response like this before. In 1 week, we have gotten 600 extremely negative letters and one positive letter. Did you write it under a pseudonym? And I said, no, I had nothing to do with any of this. He said, well, he said, Harold, we feel we have to print about a dozen of the negative letters. Would you like to see them first? I said, no, I don't want to see them first. And I never read the Wall Street Journal anyway. I'll never see them. Just go ahead, Max. It's all in the best interest. But boy, it's gone on and on because under the policy of Dow Jones, who owns the Wall Street Journal, they have they allowed it to be translated into many languages and reprinted in many American places. And for a while, my wife and I were getting so much negative email, and I kept getting so many negative letters at Yale, that after a while, we just had to stop reading the email and the letters. Many of them were from outraged young men and young women protesting their brilliance and at the same time saying that they thought that Harry Potter was very grand. But as a matter of fact, Vic, this book was conceived, as I say in the introduction, originally as a kind of companion volume for How to Read and Why, under the title of The Solitary Reader. Then I decided, no, I wanted something with an emphasis more for, you might say, older children, and then I finally decided, indeed, for children of all ages. And I suppose that the title, in a mild way, sort of is a little playfully joking in regard to what I do think is the terrible dumbing down of our culture, and in particular of our literary culture. But I can really say that I'm innocent, that it wasn't my personal crusade against Harry Potter which had anything to do with the formation of this book. So it's very, very interesting how once you get started on something, they don't let you alone. When the Today Show a couple of weeks ago, with the coming out of the Harry Potter movie, wished to have me on at 7 a.m. with two people fiercely pro-Potter. And I said, well, first of all, 7 a.m. is a little early in the morning for a man of 71. And secondly, I said, much more important, I would appear as the Grinch that stole Christmas, you know. I don't really want to play that kind of a role. I don't want to have to explain, you know, that I don't like to read endless cliches and that I feel that this is going to be seen as the rubbish it is 6 or 7 or 8 years from now, but it's just an invidious position to be in, so I declined to appear on the Today Show. And then various other things came up, and I declined to appear. And suddenly, and I find this fascinating, NPR, National Public Radio, got in touch with somebody at Yale about a week ago because they were having a program. This is obviously with the Tolkien film approaching. They were having a program with some guy who had written a book called Tolkien, the Greatest Writer of the 20th Century. And when I heard that, I told this lady at Yale, I said, no, tell them that Professor Bloom is afraid of apoplexy. If he has to get on the radio and remind people that Marcel Proust, James Joyce, Franz Kafka, Samuel Beckett, and at least 5,000 other authors lived in the 20th century and were all, in fact, considerably more powerful and lasting writers than Tolkien. I mean, Tolkien is a cut above Rowling. Now I'm getting it endlessly on Tolkien because I came in today from a walk to hear on my answering machine there's somebody in Fort Worth who wants to talk to me about Tolkien and somebody else from NPR, and I think I'm just going to quietly shut myself down as I don't want to discuss Tolkien any more than I want to discuss Rowling. Nobody, I think, wants to get set up as the eternal naysayer. That's not my function.
Well, we really appreciate the fact that you were willing to talk to us today, Harold, because...
But we are not talking about Harry Potter.
Well, I did start off that way, but I wanted to get it out of the way. And it was apparent to me during all this brouhaha that you were trying to be constructive, and you were trying to lead people to better things, to good reading.
It is a very vital issue indeed. I mean, the defense that I hear constantly, including from parents, you know, of people I know, you know, children I know, and so on. I've gotten a great many people whom I don't know. What they're always saying is, well, look, my son and my daughter is willing to read Harry Potter, and they're not willing to read anything else, which in itself, of course, is a shocking thing to be told. But then the notion seems to be that, well, if they read Harry Potter, then they'll go on to read other things. That was taken care of by that great American writer Stephen King, who in that great American publication, which I can bear less and less, Mr. Chip McGrath's Sunday Times Book Review, which the standard of sheer literacy is amazingly low, let alone any standard of critical judgment. Stephen King reviewed the latest Harry Potter book, and he ended his review by giving the whole thing away. He said, I'm quoting verbatim, he said, it's absolutely wonderful. He said, if these kids, when they're 11 and 12, are reading Harry Potter, then they'll be ready to go on to read Stephen King when they're 13 and 14 and 15. I rest my case. It's endless. It's endless. Yesterday, somebody from a prominent New York magazine, I will not identify it, called me to say, would you consider writing something on Stephen King? And I said, no, why would I write something on Stephen King? And they said, well, our editor-in-chief thinks that Stephen King is greatly underrated. In fact, he thinks that Stephen King is the Charles Dickens of the 20th century, at which I groaned miserably and said, well, I'm sorry to terminate the conversation, but enough is enough. So I've got to be very wary of this, it seems to me.
Harold, you have my sympathy.
No. I mean, it's kind of you to give me your sympathy, but it's in a way, it's my own fault. But, you know, I still haven't recovered from the experience. I've only read the one Potter book, which I did, you know, when I was asked to do this thing for the Wall Street Journal. And I was startled by how bad it was. It was the first one, The Sorcerer's Stone. I picked up the paperback in the Yale bookstore, and I kept noticing the fact that nobody in the book ever took a walk. They stretched their legs.
Uh-huh.
He or she stretched their legs, or they stretched their legs. So I started to keep a little, on the back of an envelope nearby, I put down a check mark for each time we got the phrase stretching their legs or stretching his or her legs. And when I reached 22, I just stopped. I mean, that really is cliche writing of the worst kind.
Mm-hmm.
That is someone who cannot write her way out of a paper bag. And, of course, you know, this is a hopeless situation when one is dealing with an author who is being read in all languages by tens and tens of millions of both adults and children. And quite clearly, we are in a time where penny dreadfuls, as they used to be called, are being exalted to the status of the monuments of our culture. It's not a good time.
Hmm. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, a reprise of my 2001 interview with Professor Harold Bloom, and we were discussing his book Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. And coming up in this next segment, a real treat. I'll never forget the day I talked to Harold on the telephone, and he went into poetry straight from memory. He loved the poetry of Lewis Carroll, the writer who brought us Alice in Wonderland. And he talks about Lewis Carroll, and he recites some Carroll poetry, and it is really fabulous to hear him do it. We'll bring you that segment coming up on the Best of the Book Nook, but first this. My guest is Harold Bloom. Well, Harold, you have suggested a remedy in a way to some of this dumbing down with this new collection.
Well, I have put together what I think is it's a good collection. I carefully, it's got 83 poems and 41 stories in it. I think that's the number. I'd have to look at the beginning of the introduction, which I'm not doing at the moment. But I think it's 41 stories. That's it, and 83 poems, including one long poem, Christina Rossetti's Goblin's Market. And I very carefully chose nothing which was written after the First World War, you know, after which the various waves of modernism came, because I wanted fantasy and visionary quality and, you know, sort of primal storytelling and high lyrical poetry. And I have put together a very great collection. I've been going around reading from it. Would you indulge me while I read my favorite poem from the whole collection?
I would be delighted.
You know the marvelous poem by Lewis Carroll called A Pigtail?
I would love to hear that.
I will start it from memory, and then if I have trouble, I will pick up the book. There was a pig that sat alone beside a ruined pump. By day and night he made his moan. It would have stirred a heart of stone to see him wring his hoofs and groan, because he could not jump. A certain camel heard him shout, a camel with a hump. Oh, is it grief or is it gout? What is this bellowing about? That pig replied with quivering snout, because I cannot jump. That camel scanned him dreamy-eyed, methinks you are too plump. I never knew a pig so wide that wobbled so from side to side, who could, however much he tried, do such a thing as jump. Yet mark those trees 2 miles away, all clustered in a clump. If you could trot there twice a day, not ever pause for rest or play, in the far future, who can say you may be fit to jump? That camel passed and left him there beside the ruined pump. Oh, horrid was that pig's despair. His shrieks of anguish filled the air. He wrung his hoofs, he rent his hair, because he could not jump. There was a frog that wandered by, a sleek and shining lump, inspected him with fishy eye and said, oh, pig, what makes you cry? And bitter was that pig's reply, because I cannot jump. That frog, he grinned a grin of glee and hit his chest a thump. Oh, pig, he said, be ruled by me, and you shall see what you shall see. This minute for a trifling fee, I'll teach you how to jump. You may be faint from many a fall and bruised by many a bump, but if you persevere through all and practice first on something small, concluding with a 10-foot wall, you'll find that you can jump. That pig looked up with joyful start. Oh, frog, you are a thump. Your words have healed my inward smart. Come name your fee and do your part. Bring comfort to a broken heart by teaching me to jump. My fee shall be a mutton chop. My goal is ruined pump. Observe with what an airy flop I plant myself upon the top. Now bend your knees and take a hop, for that's the way to jump. Up rose that pig and rushed full whack against the ruined pump, rolled over like an empty sack and settled down upon his back, while all his bones at once went crack. It was a fatal jump. That camel passed as day grew dim around the ruined pump. Oh, broken heart, oh, broken limb, it needs, that camel said to him, something more fairy-like and slim to execute a jump. That pig lay still as any stone and could not stir a stump, nor ever, if the truth were known, was he again observed to moan, nor ever wring his hoofs and groan, because he could not jump. That frog made no remark, for he was dismal as a dump. He knew the consequence must be that he would never get his fee, and still he sits in misery upon that ruined pump. Isn't that a marvelous poem?
Wonderful. And Lewis Carroll.
It's an adorable poem. I've loved that since I was a little bear.
Clearly, Lewis is one of your favorites. He has a number in this collection.
There are more poems by Lewis Carroll than by anyone else except Anonymous.
Anonymous is right up there, and Edward Lear got a few as well.
Edward Lear is there, and there's a lot of Christina Rossetti. I am fascinated by Christina Rossetti, who was a marvelous poet. And who is especially fine, as I say, for extremely intelligent children of all ages. Do you know the Mad Gardener song by Lewis Carroll?
I remember it well.
Ah, then we will not.
But
we will not recite that.
Go, please do.
Well, it's another of my favorites in the book. He thought he saw an elephant that practiced on a fife. He looked again and found it was a letter from his wife. At length I realized, he said, the bitterness of life. He thought he saw a buffalo upon the chimney piece. He looked again and found it was his sister's husband's niece. Unless you leave this house, he said, I'll send for the police. He thought he saw a rattlesnake that questioned him in Greek. He looked again and found it was the middle of next week. The one thing I regret, he said, is that it cannot speak. He thought he saw a banker's clerk descending from the bus. He looked again and found it was a hippopotamus. If this should stay to dine, he said, there won't be much for us. He thought he saw a kangaroo that worked a coffee mill. He looked again and found it was a vegetable pill. Were I to swallow this, he said, I should be very ill. He thought he saw a coach and four that stood beside his bed. He looked again and found it was a bear without a head. Poor thing, he said, poor silly thing, it's waiting to be fed. He thought he saw an albatross that fluttered around the lamp. He looked again and found it was a penny postage stamp. You'd best be getting home, he said, the nights are very damp. He thought he saw a garden door that opened with a key. He looked again and found it was a double roll of three, and all its mystery, he said, is clear as day to me. And in the final magnificent stanza, which I love best, he thought he saw an argument that proved he was the Pope. He looked again and found it was a bar of mottled soap, a fact so dread, he faintly said, extinguishes all hope.
Harold Bloom, with a poem by Lewis Carroll from his book Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. Lewis Carroll never lost that childlike sense, did he?
Well, he was a very complex person indeed. He really was in love with little Alice Liddell. And I believe that when she was going on 16, and he must at that point have been in his middle or late 40s, something like that anyway, he actually went to Mr. and Mrs. Liddell and seriously suggested himself for their daughter's hand.
Mm.
They showed him the door and forbade, I believe, all future communication between him and the young Liddell girls.
Mm-hmm.
So he was clearly, in his gentle way, an obsessed person.
And
it certainly stimulated a remarkable imagination. There are wonderful books for children in the 20th century. I can think of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web, Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willow, James Thurber's wonderful The 13 Clocks, and many more. But I don't suppose that there are in the language anything quite as wonderful for children as Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass.
As I read the collection, Harold, I was delighted to rediscover things that I'd read when I was young, and also so many things that I had never read before. You've divided the sections up into seasons. And so
I did that partly because it's so difficult. I mean, here is a book of almost 600 pages, and here indeed, as I said, are some 80-odd poems and 40-odd stories, and I didn't want to just do them chronologically. It didn't seem very imaginative. And many, many years ago, actually 44 years ago, with my friend, the poet John Hollander, I had edited an anthology of poems for young people, which was arranged by the seasons. So I decided I would run this through a kind of seasonal cycle also. It necessarily involved a certain kind of arbitrariness at times, but sometimes it sort of worked, I thought.
Well, sometimes it's obvious why you selected a certain piece for a certain season, and I thought it was humorous that a lot of your favorite Russian writers ended up in the wintertime.
Well, a lot of my favorite Russian writers, like Gogol and even Turgenev and
Pushkin.
Certainly Pushkin and mm-hmm. the Queen of Spades are writing very beautiful but spooky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that certain things that I put in the collection, I'm really very proud of. I had known them for a long time, but they came to me at the right moment. There is a wonderful ghost story by Edith Wharton called All Souls, which I put into the winter section. And there is an equally scary and highly original story by the children's writer E. Nesbitt called In the Dark, which I put in also. And in the summer section, I've revived two wonderful Edwardian women writers who, for some reason, I don't see much about these days, Catherine Sinclair and Mary De Morgan, both of them, I think, with remarkable stories. And of course, I've led off the summer section with the longest story in the book, almost 30 pages long, John Ruskin's wonderful, I suppose it's really a novella rather than a story,
mm-hmm.
The King of the Golden River, which is a marvelous piece of mythological imagination.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting an interview I did with Professor Harold Bloom back in 2001. It was his second appearance on the program. We had him on in 1998, and he returned in 2001 to talk about Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. And Harold recited some poetry from memory during that last segment. And at the end of this final segment we have coming up, he recites another short poem. And at the time I did the interview, I had asked him about his legacy, how he wished to be remembered, and he had a hard time talking about it. His voice got very quiet, and then I think he made the decision that this poem he would share would give us some insight into how he wishes to be remembered. And at the time I recorded it back in 2001, he was 71 years old, and I'd been told that his health was fragile, and yet today, all these years later, 16 years later, Harold Bloom is still around. He's still on the faculty at Yale. He's still putting out books. He has a new book that just came out this year about Shakespeare's character Falstaff. The man is unstoppable. We'll bring you that final segment with Harold Bloom right after this. Harold Bloom joins us. His new collection, Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages, and his book, How to Read and Why, has just come out in a paperback. And as Harold mentioned, they are companions in a way.
In a way. The direction is a little bit different. I remember saying towards the end of the introduction to the Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages that if you're going to go to Shakespeare and Chekhov, if you're going to reach Henry James and Jane Austen, then you're best prepared. Obviously, I didn't put that in there. Not if you're reading J.K. Rowling and Tolkien, but if you've read Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear, Robert Louis Stevenson and Rudyard Kipling, who are very well represented in the volume. But, you know, there's a moment in the introduction which I would like to read aloud, if you'll bear with me for a second.
Certainly.
So at the end of the introduction where I say, reading well makes children more interesting both to themselves and others, a process in which they will develop a sense of being separate and distinct selves. To be alone with a true book is to be able to see more about who you are. To reread Carol's Alice books is to be reminded of how strong Alice herself is and can be a path to sharing her independence. And then I quote, "Hold your tongue," said the queen, turning purple. "I won't," said Alice. "Off with her head," the queen shouted at the top of her voice. Nobody moved. "Who cares for you?" said Alice. She had grown to her full size by this time. "You're nothing but a pack of cards." And I comment, the seven-year-old Alice is supremely courageous, and like Hamlet is only mad north-northwest. Hamlet, perhaps the most fascinating person in all literature, is a very dangerous role model, but Alice is both outrageous and prudential and well worth imitating. More than once in her or his life, every reader will grow to full size by crying out to the right auditors, "Who cares for you? You are nothing but a pack of cards."
I love that.
Well, I shouldn't say this, I suppose, but I once resigned from a English department by quoting that and then leaving the room.
Mm. That must have been a wonderfully delicious moment for you.
Well, it was. It was a very emotional moment. I have been a professor of absolutely nothing now, a non-department of one at Yale for the last 26 years.
Yes, as they like to refer to you in the New York Times book section on Sundays, the Sterling Professor.
Yes, that was, however, I think that was Chip McGrath getting back at me. I mean, he saw to it that a post-colonialist, I don't mind putting this quarrel out in the public, this is a fellow who had once been my graduate student at Yale and then departed graduate school and then reviewed my Western Canon book back in the days when he was working for the New Yorker by opening his review by saying, "Every time I take the train from Boston to New York and it stops in New Haven, I put the newspaper up about my head for fear that Professor Bloom will walk in and see me and say, 'McGrath, where is that essay on Wallace Stevens you owe me?'" Which was a pretty good joke. But then he didn't exactly win my heart by assigning my How to Read and Why to, of all people, a post-colonialist. You know who those people are?
Mm-hmm.
Post-colonialist denounced it and said, "Well, it's not a good book at all. I mean, how could it be a good book? It's not greatly interested in post-colonialism. It isn't even interested in, never mind. There are all sorts of things it is not interested in. The stuff that keeps the academy going these days.
So the New York Times continues to be a bramble.
The New York Times Book Review and I are in, I guess, a sort of permanent state of war until such time as Chip McGrath stops being the editor of it.
My guest is Harold Bloom. His new collection, Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages, has just been published by Scribner. And also the paperback of How to Read and Why has just come out. And he joins us by telephone from New Haven, where he's just celebrated his 50th year of residence.
Alas, yes, I am 71 years old, celebrating 50 years in the same university. Reminds one, after all, that one got here as a graduate student, having just turned 21, and now one is 71 and a half. I wish there were time to read aloud my favorite story in the book, which is the outrageous piece called Journalism in Tennessee by
Mark Twain,
but it would take too long. I read it aloud at a couple of readings, and even though it's short, it turned out to be longer than I thought. But it is. There are a number of very funny stories in the book, but in some ways I thought that was the most outrageously funny. So I can, without reading it, just from the very beginning of it.
Or you can read it if you like, Harold.
No, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just at the very beginning of it, I love the opening sentence. I was told by the physician that a southern climate would improve my health, and so I went down to Tennessee and got a berth on the Morning Glory and Johnson County War Whoop as associate editor. Isn't that wonderful? A Tennessee newspaper called the Morning Glory and Johnson County War Whoop. What could be a better name for a newspaper?
There will never be another writer like him.
No, I don't think we will have the equivalent of Mr. Clemens, or as he called himself, Mark Twain. Again, I do care immensely for the number of poems by Christina Rossetti that I put into the book. She is one of my favorite poets. She was a devotional poet of a remarkable kind. But also, in a very sad way, a love poet. And, I'm not sure what page it's on, but I know that somewhere in this book is that beautiful song, When I Am Dead, My Dearest, Sing No Sad Songs for Me. Plant thou no roses at my head, nor shady cypress tree. Be the green grass above me with showers and dewdrops wet. And if thou wilt remember, and if thou wilt forget, I shall not see the shadows, I shall not feel the rain, I shall not hear the nightingale sing on as if in pain, and dreaming through the twilight that doth not rise nor set, haply I may remember, and haply may forget. I find that a perfect poem. But she wrote many really superb poems. I must say also that in putting the book together, I found many old friends among the stories that I had not read for many years. Nathaniel Hawthorne's magnificent story about a scarecrow called Feathertop, and then the wonderful story by H.G. Wells called The Remarkable Case of Davidson's Eyes, a very short and really rather astonishing story. And even though I am not, on the whole, one of the great admirers of Edgar Allan Poe, I put in William Wilson because it is a story that works, even if Poe's style at times bothers me a great deal. And also, the most wonderful, I think, of all of O. Henry's stories, the one called
Witch's Loaves.
And the scariest.
It doesn't get any butter than that, does it?
No, it doesn't. Or the scariest of Maupassant's stories, The Horla.
The Horla,
Every time I read it, it really frightens me again. And then just marvelous stories that, you know, should be better known than they are. Thomas Hardy's wonderful The Three Strangers. and Ali the Persian story of the Kurd Sharpa from the Arabian Nights, and just story after story, that Remarkable Rocket by Oscar Wilde, wonderful The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane, which I think is exactly right for somebody at any age, but is especially fine, I think, when you're 12 or 14 or 15. But it doesn't wear off. It keeps its splendor.
As we look back at so many of these writers that you've just mentioned, Robert Louis Stevenson, Edgar Allan Poe, Stephen Crane, so many of them died so young.
Well, tuberculosis was an enormous problem. It was a great killer in the 19th century. It killed John Keats when he was 25 years old, and that is pretty awful. I mention Keats because his beautiful sonnet called The Human Seasons leads off the book. And one doesn't forget, you know, of all the many, many losses to tuberculosis in the 19th century, that was, I think, in many ways the greatest. That really was a terrible loss.
He holds a special place in your heart, doesn't he?
Oh, sure. But I think anyone who reads poetry, he was F. Scott Fitzgerald's favorite poet, and for good reason.
Do you write your own poetry, Harold?
No. No, from the time I was a very small boy, I loved reading and memorizing and reciting poems more than almost any other activity. But it became for me, therefore, a kind of sacred threshold guarded by demons or daimons, and it never occurred to me that one could cross over into it. No, I'm afraid I write literary criticism, but I think the direction of the way I write criticism has changed a great deal in the last 12 or 15 years or even more. I think partly because in the middle 1980s, I started doing all those, quite literally, hundreds and hundreds, it must by now be well over 1,000, Chelsea House critical anthologies in which, you know, I wanted to so write the introductions and the editor's notes that they would be immediately accessible to a student in a junior high school. And that taught me, I think, how to be much plainer and more direct. But as the universities and their one-time English departments increasingly became departments of cultural studies, you know, as literature ceased more and more to be taught and was just replaced by, oh, it's too tiresome to call it political correctness, but I don't want to say, you know, anything stronger because I'm so weary of this. I have now crawled bleeding off so many canonical battlegrounds that I suppose that's one reason why I'm very weary of the notion of taking up, you know, my sword again to try to do something, and of course it's hopeless, about the ascendancy of Rowling, Tolkien at all. But I have found, starting with the books that I began to write about 1988 right down to the current day, that it is very possible indeed to write for a very large audience indeed. And I think that has sustained me, and sustained me more than financially. It has sustained me emotionally and intellectually. I found that each time I have published a new book, be it Shakespeare, The Invention of the Human, or The Western Canon, or How to Read and Why, I've gone out on the road and done readings from the book before literally tens of thousands of people all over the world, but especially all over the United States as well. And, you know, they have been people young and old, male and female, white and black and Asian American, so-called white. I always wonder why we say white. I remember E.M. Forster quite wonderfully saying, why do we call it white? What we really mean is pinko gray.
Uh-huh.
Someone should speak of the pinko grays. But, you know, I have found myself terribly moved by these audiences. You know, one always gets there a couple of hours in advance and stays a couple of hours later, ostensibly to sign books, but I don't just sign books. I sit there and I talk to people and they talk back to me, and it has been, for me, profoundly educational and very heartening, because the more and more I have felt that I was the pariah of my profession, the more I came to realize that my profession had committed suicide and was now a pariah as far as the common reader, the ordinary reader of the Western world was concerned.
My guess is Harold Bloom. Harold, as you look back at your legacy and the things that you've done in your life, how would you like to be remembered?
Oh, dear. Only a very few literary critics, Vic, dear, can ever be remembered. Dr. Samuel Johnson, who's my special hero, William Hazlitt, Coleridge, just a few more. Kenneth Burke and William Empson in the 20th century. I don't know.
I understand you've just finished a new book.
I have finished this vast new book called Genius, A Mosaic of 100 Exemplary Creative Minds. It will be published by Warner Books probably early next October. It's a vast book. It's a 1,000-page manuscript. I suppose it will print up even longer than the Shakespeare book, which was 750 pages. This will probably be something like 800 pages. I don't know. It just was something that I felt I had to do. I have no idea how one is going to be remembered or if one is going to be remembered, how one is going to be remembered. Well, I hope, you know, I have had to engage in a great deal of polemic. I've gotten into a lot of battles. I don't want to be remembered as being quarrelsome. I hope I'm not remembered as having been quarrelsome. I don't think I was naturally quarrelsome. I think what has happened to our once high culture, or what we thought was our high culture in the last 33 or 34 years, from about 1967 until now, sort of forced me into a situation of, well, almost intense and incessant polemic. But I don't think I'm really polemical by nature. I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, everybody would like to hope that they're going to be remembered, at least by a few friends. I don't know, dear. I'm not sure I can answer that. I know how I'd like to end our program, though. I'd like to read the very last poem in this book, which is again by Christina Rossetti. And I will read this. I think I know it by heart, but I don't want to take any chances with it. It's on page 568 of the book. It's a lyric called Uphill by Christina Rossetti. And she belonged to a rather esoteric Anglican sect, intensely devout, which believed in a doctrine called soul sleep, which held that when you died, your soul didn't die, but it did go to sleep and rested a very long time. And then when the general resurrection came, your soul would no longer be weary. And I find this a perfect poem. It's called Uphill. Does the road wind uphill all the way? Yes, to the very end. Will the day's journey take the whole long day from morn to night, my friend? But is there for the night a resting place, a roof for when the slow dark hours begin? May not the darkness hide it from my face? You cannot miss that inn. Shall I meet other wayfarers at night, those who have gone before? Then must I knock or call when just in sight? They will not keep you standing at that door. Shall I find comfort, travel sore and weak? Of labor, you shall find the sum. Will there be beds for me and all who seek? Yea, beds for all who come. I find that, I don't know whether I believe in the doctrine of soul sleep or precisely what I believe about immortality or resurrection. But I'm haunted by that poem.
Harold Bloom, It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Vic. It was very touching for me. Be well, my dear.
If you could stay on the line, Harold.
Okay.
The book is Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. Our guest has been Harold Bloom. You've been listening to The Book Nook. You've been listening to the best of The Book Nook on WYSO, my 2001 interview with Professor Harold Bloom about his book, Stories and Poems for Extremely Intelligent Children of All Ages. That book, like many of his 40 books, is still in print, still sells very well. And it's not just a book for children. I dare say many of you out there listening probably haven't read most of the material in the book, which he considers to be very important. And he's still writing books. He's still around. His most recent book is about Falstaff, the Shakespearean character. It came out this year. Before that, he has slowed down a little bit. He's not putting out a book a year anymore, but his previous book came out in 2015, and it was called The Daemon Knows, Literary Greatness and the American Sublime. And in that book, he names his 12 important American writers, and they are poets and novelists. And the names on the list are Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Emily Dickinson, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry James, Mark Twain, Robert Frost, Wallace Stevens, T.S. Eliot, William Faulkner, and Hart Crane. And in this lengthy book, he defends his choices and explains them. And he's an amazing guy. When we recorded that interview, he was 71 years old. He had been on the faculty at Yale for 50 years. And in that interview, you heard him talk about his resignation from the English department. He didn't say what English department that was. At the time we interviewed him, he was also teaching at NYU as well as Yale. I'm guessing he was referring to Yale, but I don't know. He could be a bit prickly. In fact, he's been involved in controversies over the years for criticizing popular writers. You heard his take on Harry Potter at the beginning of that interview. He's also criticized writers like Adrian Rich and David Foster Wallace. In 2004, the feminist author Naomi Wolf wrote an article in New York Magazine claiming that Harold Bloom had committed what she called sexual encroachment upon her a couple of decades before by touching her thigh. And Harold defended himself. When asked about the allegations many years later, just a couple years ago, he said, quote, "I refuse to even use the name of this person. I call her Dracula's daughter because her father was a Dracula scholar. I have never in my life been indoors with Dracula's daughter. When she came to the door of my house unbidden, my youngest son turned her away. Once I was walking up to campus, and she fell in with me and said, 'May I walk with you, Professor Bloom?' I said nothing." He can be very prickly, and all these years later, still going strong. He was born on July 11th, 1930, and he is still the Sterling Professor of Humanities at Yale University. He published his first book in 1959. He has been a member of the Yale English Department since 1955. He graduated that same year from Yale with his PhD in English. He has also been involved in the creation of Ralston College in Savannah, Georgia, which focuses on primary texts. He married Jean Gould in 1958, and this book that he put out in 2015, The Daemon Knows, is dedicated to her. And I was kind of surprised he hadn't dedicated a book to her before. He says, "For my wife, Jean." They have two children. In an interview 12 years ago, with Jean, she was asked if she was an atheist. And she said that they are both atheists. And then he denied it. He said, no, no, I'm not an atheist. It's no fun being an atheist, he said. Harold Bloom, you got to love him. I wish I could get him back on the program, but I don't think that's going to happen. And that's why we had the Best of the Book Nook. I hope you enjoyed it. Stay tuned for more great entertainment on this radio station. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCumis.